This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, where we usually talk about planning, politics and development from across London. But today we have a special live recording of the Better Places podcast from the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, discussing the ongoing housing crisis, the extension of devolved powers and some wonderful insights from our panel. Hosted and chaired by our very own Catherine Rose and Sidhu Dwyer, alongside our fantastic group that includes John Denham, the Director of the Labour English Network, Brenda Dakers, the Mayor of Lewisham, Councillor Vince Maple, Medway Council Leader, Councillor Anthony O'Kerrickey, Greenwich Council Leader, Councillor Sharma Tatler, Cabinet Member for Regeneration, Planning and Growth in Brent, Graham Craig, Chief Executive at Places for London, and Kevin Henson, Partner at Gerald Eve.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Better Places Live. Devolution and revolution, how we'll go about building the 1.5 million new homes that this new Labour government is setting out to do. We meet at a time, 15 years in fact, since Labour was last in government. This is my 10th conference. And I'm sure for many of the speakers who are sat here on the panel, is a conference that is perhaps unusual. The policies that those ministers of state, secretaries of state, are looking to implement or even discuss at this conference are actually going to make a difference to, in my mind, jolting the home starts that we need. And we've seen stalling of housing starts across the country. In London alone, we have seen a decline of around 3,000 new housing starts each year. We're not meeting nearly enough to cover the amount of people who are living in temporary accommodation. We're having to move, in the case of London, a number of homelessness families from outside of the capital and to parts of the country that they're not familiar with because of the shortage of new homes. Here at Consilio Communications, and my colleague Catherine Rose will also chair this event, we work with a range of decision makers, as you've seen on this panel, from across London, across England. We also have here a former Secretary of State. Also those in industry, whether they are planners or house builders, to create better places, give people a home and the security that they need, and help them achieve whether it's their full potential or just to lead a better life for them and their families. Welcome to have a interesting and quite lively discussion. We're going to explore perhaps the revolutions in their own patches, or more devolved powers that they would like to see given to them, or perhaps shared among whether it's regional leaders or those in Whitehall, to meet the housing needs that we are seeing in London, across the southeast, but also England. And it's in that we're grateful to have the English Labour Network endorse this event, and we are hoping we'll demonstrate what's needed to end the housing crisis. So this is a live recording of the Better Places podcast. I'd like you all to give a huge round of applause as we begin this afternoon's discussion. I'll hand over to Catherine Rose. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for that. Yes, my name is Catherine Rose, and for the purposes of today, I'm chairing this panel discussion, which will then open up to the floor and get interaction between all you as attendees and get the insights and expertise and experiences of our panel members. So we're hoping for a very informal, lively discussion. So without further ado, I will do a brief introduction of our panel today. From the Labour English Network, its director and co-founder, Mr. John Denham, the Right Honourable John Denham. John served as MP for Southampton Itchen for 23 years, from 1992 to 2015. He had a distinguished ministerial career under both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's premierships. Minister of State from 1997 to 2001, and then that was the Department of Social Security, the Department of Health and the Home Office. John was chair of the influential Home Affairs Select Committee from 2003 to 2007, and then he was appointed as Secretary of State for Innovation, University and Skills. He then served as the Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government from 2009 to 2010. Not long after leaving Parliament, John was a key instigator for the creation of the English Labour Network. It was formed in 2017 to encourage the Labour Party to recognise and embrace the distinct political identity of England and to thereby strengthen support for the party throughout the country. So it's fair to say that John has been the champion for greater devolution across England, and that he is that devolution must adhere to and deliver on Labour values. And I'm sure his influence will continue collaborating within the Labour Network Action Bill as it evolves over coming months. So we're delighted to be collaborating with the English Labour Network today. Also on the panel today is Mr. Kevin Henson from Gerald Eve. He has unique insight and understanding of the public sector, political interactions and the challenges of local government. Also on our panel today is Mr. Graham Craig, Chief Executive of Places for London. Graham leads Transport for London's wholly owned commercial property subsidiary, and they are charged with building 20,000 new homes and a portfolio of commercial offices across London and the Greater London area. They manage over 2,500 commercial tenants, 93% of whom are small and medium-sized enterprises, with over 1,000 retail units in and around stations and 850 railway arches. And then we move on to our stellar group of Labour leaders in their respective councils. So we're going to gain insights from the political realities facing Labour councils in their efforts to deliver new homes, and particularly new council homes or those homes at social rent. So I'm delighted to welcome, first and foremost, Brenda Dacres, the Mayor of Lewisham. Brenda has lived and worked in Lewisham for over 40 years. She's a single mum, the first in her family to go to university. She's got not one but two degrees in science and law, and she was first elected as councillor for New Cross Ward in 2014. Brenda's held several senior roles in Lewisham, including chair of Lewisham Labour Group and cabinet responsibilities, prior to becoming elected Mayor of Lewisham in May 2024. Congratulations on your victory, Brenda. And then Councillor Anthony Akeraker, leader of Greenwich Council. He's born and raised in Greenwich. Anthony was the first elected, first and foremost as councillor for Woolwich Common in 2018. And after what can only be described as a stellar and rapid rise within Greenwich politics, he was elected leader of the council in 2022. And prior to this, Anthony enjoyed a professional career in planning and engagement. And Councillor Shamma Tatler, she's the cabinet member for Regeneration, Planning and Growth at Brent Council. And she's a leading exponent for the wider Labour YIMBY movement across England. She's the councillor for Kingsbury Ward in Brent and has been so since 2014. And Shamma oversees some of the largest regeneration schemes in England, let alone London. She also works with the Local Government Association to support and mentor other councillors across the country. She offers her insight, skills and practical experience. And prior to politics, Shamma was a secondary school teacher and head of history and humanities. And then finally, Councillor Vince Maple, the leader of Medway Council. Vince has been councillor for Chatham Central and latterly Chatham Central and Brompton since 2007. And Vince became the youngest leader of a Labour group in 2012. And it's fair to say that Vince has spearheaded a legendary example of political activism in his region and that part of Kent. His growing culminated in May 2023 when Labour won the majority and took control of the council, ending 20 years of Tory rule. Let's congratulate Vince again on his victory in 23. So by way of opening remarks, I intend to sort of ask a directing question to members of the panel. And I think I'll start with John. And John, if you're able to, I'm sure you are, give us your thoughts and that of your network in regards to Labour's devolution inheritance and what the impact of 14 years of Tory government has been on devolution structures. And perhaps through the lens of the housing crisis or other examples, what you feel might need to be done or must be done really to learn from the lessons of the past and to shape the next 14 years of devolution for England and fundamentally create the structures that can deliver 1.5 million new homes.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Catherine, and also to Cillo, and thank you to Consilio for inviting us to join in this this important discussion. Just very quickly about the English Labour Network, for those of you who've not heard of it, we a relatively small group of activists. We describe ourselves as being for England, for Labour in England, and for England in Labour, by which the first part of which we mean wanting to see Labour win in every part of England. So we're very happy to take all the credit for July's result, where we were. But it's worth remembering, when we were started in 2017 and we first said that, there were plenty of people in the Labour Party who said Labour can never win a majority in England. We can only do it across the across Britain as a whole. That England and Britain are not the same place, that Wales and Scotland are not having this debate that we're having on devolution and planning in the same terms, and we often talk about, forget that a significant number of voters identify as English as much as they vote as British. So that's what we're about. Now, on this platform, I need to be quite clear, we have support from right across the party, so we tend to avoid detailed domestic policy. We think there should be a manifesto for England, because so much of English policy is separate from that of Wales and Scotland, but we don't say what should be in it. So I'm slightly risky of offending my friends in the room, including Vince Maple, who's always been a great supporter of ours, by getting into this policy area. But the one thing that we do agree on is that England is far too centralised, and we will not solve the problems that we as a party want to solve unless there is radical devolution. And by that we mean power should be devolved by right and not by the permission of central government. It shouldn't be the case that devolved power has to be earned, whereas the same powers in any other European country would be constitutionally vested in local government. And secondly, part of that devolved debate, we think that devolution applies at many different levels. So it shouldn't just be about mayors and combined local authorities, it should be about other local authorities too. There are different powers that should lie at different levels. So looking at the inheritance, and to be provocative, let me pose it this way. At the moment, and on the current announcement this week, we are rolling forward the question, is the agenda significantly going to change? And the issue I'd raise, and I think it's important in relation to housing, is whether we need to rethink that approach if we're going to deliver on the government's missions. Because the missions, if they mean anything, and I'm a huge enthusiast for the approach, imply nothing less than a restructuring of the UK state. So there's a devolution of power across the nations and across the localities, which is well coordinated to make sure that we meet those missions, and that is true of housing as anything else. So what that means is when we look at the housing debate in devolution, instead of thinking about how can this group of combined local authorities put themselves together to get these additional powers so they get a bit more permission to do a bit more, we need to say what needs to be in place to deliver our housing objectives. So I'm just going to list a few without explaining them, because we can come back to that in the discussion. Firstly, spatial planning. Right? We are going to build 3.5 Birminghams in the next 4 years. And we're going to do that without any serious spatial planning in place in England. Can you successfully build 3.5 Birminghams in 4 years without spatial planning in place? Our current ambition is to have spatial planning in place by the end of this parliament. I think there's a mismatch there, so I think we should be accelerating the rollout of spatial planning ahead of our current agendas. Secondly, spatial planning means nothing unless it goes with the power for infrastructure, transport, skills, schools, health service, water. I mean, in Hampshire, it's difficult to build nitrate runoff, so we don't actually have control over the powers of the agencies that deal with nitrate runoff. So that means devolving those powers rapidly. It also means ensuring that strategic plans as they are developed by existing combined authorities and new ones cannot be cut across by, for example, Homes England or Highways England having a different set of priorities that don't fit in with that local strategic spatial planning. And we can say the same about skills. So we've got welcome promise in the King's Speech of devolution of skills and buses. But there's got to be a way of doing that that ties in with the other powers. They can't just float off as separate activities of local authorities. And crucially, of course, social housing. That needs, I mean, I'm very old, so I can remember when social housing was council housing. And then I can remember a period of time where local authorities were able to strategically take an approach to social housing. And now we're in a world where there's sometimes no relationship between social housing providers and the strategies of local authorities. We need to do social housing in a way that brings that sort of democratic. We're not going to go back to every house being a council house, but there has to be, I think, that strategic sense of local authority. And then finally, I don't believe, and we can debate this on the panel, that you can deliver 1.5 million houses with a housing construction market the way that operates at the moment, with control of land supply, release of land, quite uncompetitive building for construction and all the rest of it. That means within the local devolution structure, there needs to be power to all the development that takes place on it. So I just want to stir things up a bit in a way, because yes, there is going to be more devolution under a Labour government. There's absolutely no doubt about that. There will be changes to the way things are done. There's no doubt about it. But if we take the mission approach and work back from what we want to achieve, I think we get to a much more radical devolutionary approach than we have yet set out. But I'm not pessimistic, because I believe there's going to be a white paper. There is definitely going to be a bill later this year. And I think those are the sorts of arguments we should be injecting into the debate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. So my first question I'll put to Anthony, if that's all right, Anthony. So what is stopping you building more homes in Greenwich? And do you need more powers? And should housing in Greenwich be determined by you, the Mayor of London, or Angela Rayner?
Thank you very much. First of all, welcome everyone. I have to say it's great to be live on the podcast. I always feel you have the best jingle other than the countdown. But obviously we're here for a serious topic, which is all about housing. And I guess when we think about the different issues that we have when in Greenwich, and by the way, just before I go into it, one thing I will say is that when you get councillors and leaders on a panel, everyone's going to tell you that their borough is the best.
He's getting in now.
Now, I trust that you as an audience won't believe the shenanigans. But in Greenwich, we have a real ambitious about making sure to deliver more housing. Ambitious in the sense that it isn't just about building, it's about making sure people are housed decently. It's about making sure we get children out of temporary accommodation and making sure that actually the basis of tackling poverty is about getting people into the right homes. Elderly people into the right homes, not in three bedrooms. Young people into purpose-built student accommodation, and making sure people have access to good housing. So that ambition that we share collectively on this panel is all about that. So some of the difficulties we face can be brought into three different issues: money, trust, and freedom. Money, in the sense that the market has ground to a halt, build costs are up, it's difficult to deliver anything at the moment. If you come to Greenwich today, I've got a site for 15 homes on a small site, and it's going to take me 600,000 just to deliver one home. It's now cheaper to just buy off the open market. So at the moment, councils are really struggling to be able to deliver at the moment, at a time where we need to be delivering. Housing associations are not delivering at the moment. They've slowed down at a time where they need to be delivering housing. So when I say we need money, we need a cash injection in the system to get ourselves out of where we are right now to be able to continue to deliver. And that cash injection is all about, actually, we know it's difficult to build at the moment, it's difficult to get in skills, we know the market's slowing down. Let us think about how we start to do more acquisitions in London and make sure we're delivering more social and affordable housing as we're doing that, to get more cash to be able to deliver homes. It gave us more freedom to be able to live, and I think councils all around the country have shown just what they can do when you give them the responsibility and the trust that they need to deliver for their communities. And actually, we shouldn't have had to wait that long to be able to do that. But we need that more trust to be able to deliver for our communities. And that's a good example of the work we're doing. We're doing joint ventures. We're looking at our estates again. We're thinking about how we recreate and restitch places and communities. As councillors, we know our own areas. And as leaders, we know our own areas. And actually, if you give us the freedom and trust to be able to work together, we can collectively do that work. We need more freedom. And that freedom is that, look, I'm already in a devolved area where we have the Mayor of London, but there's also various layers to that. Obviously, we have the council, we have the mayor, we have the government, then we have Homes England, then you have another department, right? So there's always different departments all in that mix. And we need the freedom to be able to work together a bit more with our gloves off, in some sense. If you come to Greenwich, you've got the Thamesmead and Abbeywood opportunity area. And actually, what we're trying to do down there is get a new DLR station to be able to deliver about 15,000 homes on the Greenwich side. But where are the discussions? We have a board that works really well. But Homes England keeps their cards close to their chest. We keep our cards close to the chest. And, you know, government does and the mayor does. And actually, we just need to get rid of that. Now, the government's position about setting out different missions is going to be a huge game changer. And now talking about joint decision making is the game changer to change the culture. And I think that's going to work really well if we are all invested. No longer can we afford to work in silos when it comes to thinking about how we tackle the housing crisis. Because the more we do that, the more we create scenarios where people are left in a one-bedroom flat with nine people. So on the last point in terms of Angela Rayner, the mayor, and myself, I think it should all come to me, I'm joking. On that last point, I think it's collaboration. I think it's a collection. Yeah. I want to see that collective thinking where there are more strategic sites. I've got Charlton Riverside in my area, and actually there's fragmented land ownership, 35 different owners. How do I pull all that together when I'm, you know, trying to protect a child who's costing me 25,000 a week, trying to stop people in temporary accommodation, trying to deliver all the other things, and, you know, and someone's come to me and said, I want more culture. Right? That's where I need the mayor. That's where I need Angela Rayner coming in and saying, actually, Anthony, we're going to pull everyone together and help you. Because we collectively need to send a message to the market of what we're trying to deliver in places. And the market will provide when you are clear and they see the buy-in from responsible leaders. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Anthony. I just wanted to bring in the industry flag at this point, and I just wondered whether both Craig and Kevin wanted to give insights, considering the very powerful message that Anthony's just delivered around the barriers that he faces. What you, Kevin, what do you currently think around the proposals, the prospect of a devolution bill, and more specifically the planning reforms that are still open for consultation from the 24 hours? And how quickly you'd want to see the response back from government and what you would hope and your aspirations around what the government will actually propose in response to the issues of money, trust and freedom that Anthony summarised.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Catherine. Yeah, we've heard a lot about the housing crisis. And whilst a lot has been said about reforming planning to enable more housing to be delivered, I think we all acknowledge it's not just the planning system, there's finance. A release of land, and we're hearing that CPO is going to be reformed in the future, which is great in terms of enabling land to be acquired more readily by local authorities. Beyond that, there's obviously construction issues. I think in terms of what the government have done so far, they've been very quick out of the starter blocks. It's fantastic to see the delivery of the New Homes Accelerator programme to be able to unblock sites that are currently stuck in the system. The future ambitions for New Town Commission, which is very much going to obviously be the next parliamentary term by the time any spades get put in the ground there. And obviously the MPPF, which, as I say, is open for the next 24 hours. If you've got any last-minute takers on that, do put your comments in. But I think the MPPF, I think, probably needs to go a bit more bolder, because I think we're all talking about 1.5 million homes need to be delivered in the next parliamentary term. And it's great to have that at 1990, at the end of Thatcher's period. The housing need was identified as 4.4 million homes. We are today at 4.3 million homes need. What we've been doing for the last 33 years hasn't really scratched the surface. If we are going to actually make a big dent into that and actually start dealing with the housing needs of the population, there really needs to be a more strategic and thought-through approach. And I think, as John was saying, that needs to actually start by understanding how the regions can deliver for their communities. And actually ensure they have the powers to acquire the land and deliver the infrastructure required to support housing at high density.
Thank you. thanks for that. And Graham, do you want to add in terms of your mission? You've got a mission-led organisation in terms of a clear target and an established community of tenants and sort of partnerships on the ground, but then you're also under clear direction to deliver 20,000 new homes. What is your response to the planning reforms, or what would you like to see in the context of your organisation to be able to deliver on that?
Thanks, Catherine, and thanks also for the invitation to speak here. To my mind, just setting out a context that says homes matter is important, probably the single most helpful, important thing from us. Combined with, let me give you an example, Fosters, we waited for 2 years for approval from the Secretary of State to allow us to bring forward 350 homes. Getting that approval helps us bring those homes forward. London has a housing crisis. It doesn't have a car parking crisis. You know, and just the ability to bring forward those homes and the message that that sends, that for me is what's important. We've already built 1,000 homes. We're on site with over 3,000 more homes. We want to build 20,000 homes on TfL's land around station in the most attractive, most accessible locations. And half of those homes that we're going to build are affordable homes. And yes, the numbers matter, but as I like to keep saying, it's not about numbers, it's about the people who are going to live in those homes. It's giving people a front door, it's giving people a roof over their head. In a context, and the people in this room will understand it, but one in 23 children in London lives in temporary accommodation. I mean, that's just an extraordinary position to be in. On average, one child in every class is in temporary accommodation. We've got to be straining every sinew. We've got to be doing everything we can to build these homes that London needs. But it's also not just the people who are going to be occupying those homes. You know, we've got literally decades worth of development that we can bring forward on TfL's land, and we take that seriously. And we've already, even at this stage, trained up over 8,000 people in construction skills. Those are people who can move into employment to build the homes that London needs, but also those people's lives are turned around by the skills that forward. We just them. We aren't doing enough of it. I am keen that we do more. And I'm also very conscious, and this is to Anthony's point, we could do a great deal more if we work together. This isn't something that any of us can solve by ourselves. We have a collaboration agreement with Network Rail. So we've agreed to pool our land interests across London. Network Rail owns 1.5 times what TfL does in London alone. 250 opportunities where we've got adjoining land to bring forward sites. And where we can do so, I mean, it's not just homes, although that's an important part. It's also the infrastructure that we can bring forward. And obviously for us, what's important is transport infrastructure, but equally it could be the healthcare infrastructure that we can bring forward in those accessible locations next to stations. So, you know, for me, this is, it's important, it's exciting. Yes, at times it can be frustrating. It's not something that we can solve by ourselves. with others on the panel, you know, I am sure that we can do more. Anthony and I have spoken. He's got a fantastic team. I am confident that us, Network Rail, Greenwich and others, can bring forward more opportunities in Greenwich than any of us could do by ourselves. I would want to be doing the same in Greenwich, but I want to be doing the same across London. Yes. The challenge is so great. The need is so great. We can't solve it by ourselves. Let's work together and get this done.
London's transport infrastructure is the aspiration in terms of integrated transport for the rest of the country. Boroughs like Lewisham can testify as to it being currently a key barrier to further growth. So I just wondered if at this point, Brenda, you wanted to sort of add in your insights and analysis, touching on what the speakers have already mentioned.
Thank you. That is... Yeah. Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a real privilege. Thank you so much for inviting me this afternoon. And as Mr. McKenzie has just mentioned, and I was going to mention about the debate, because we got to look at the infrastructure from Brent down to Bromley. The Bakerloo line upgrade and extension would really open up southeast London, particularly Lewisham, and allow us to build in areas that we do not have the infrastructure, the transport links. And along the line, that would bring 107,000 homes just from Brent down to Bromley alone. But that's not the only obstruction that we have to building. And I want to also touch on the point that, you know, as local authorities, we have to play our part in making sure we're building homes, but we also have to make sure that our current stock is decent, that we are dealing with damp and mould, that we're also making sure that our fire regulation standards are on par as well. So there's a lot of work that we need to do, but there's a lot of stress on our finances and particularly our HRA funds. Now, I welcome the event that the government has said that they are going to look at that in the next physical event that they're going to hold. But what we really need is more stability when it comes to our local authority finances. We urgently need a framework that's rooted in clear principles that can give us the confidence and have a system that is robust and fair and sustainable. We need intervention, and that intervention needs to come from government as well. So I've mentioned about having a fair and sustainable financial long-term funding. We also, as Anthony mentioned, we need that cash injection now while they work out what that long-term financial stability. We can't go year on waiting to see what's going to be handed out to us, because we're, like many people, living hand to mouth as local authorities. We need to have a sustainable HRA. Another area that we also need to look at is the reinvestment of the right to buy receipts. Let's get 100% of that right to buy receipts back that we can invest in buying or building new homes. Let's have open conversations about, do we stop the right to buy with any new developments, new council developments that we're doing, new social housing? Let's have that open dialogue so that we can have these adult discussions as to what's right moving forward in the future. Let's look at the grants that we're utilising and making sure that we're working to get that cash injection into local authorities, because we have the skills of the capability and social to build not just homes, mixed tenures, but particularly our affordable and social homes. And one of my biggest bugbear is the fact that we have large developments or developers that are sitting on land banking, and we need legislation, we need powers to give us the ability to really push them forward, that they don't just tinker about and drill a few holes, fill them up and say, yeah, we've started now, so you can't do anything, council. We need to make sure that we are pressing them to make sure that they deliver, that they honour their commitment to build at pace in a timely manner, and that has not been happening. I'm not going to mention the names, but we have quite a few developments in Lewisham which are private developments, private land, that we are waiting for these developers to build on. And when you think that across London there are 186,000 planning applications that are just sitting there waiting for developers to be building, you know, we need that extra powers. We need that ability to say, look, you need to start building. This is not a nice way of moving forward. We've got families that need these homes. Now is not the time to be land banking. Now is the time to be building. And other changes that I would like to see is regarding, and it was mentioned earlier, it's regarding CPO powers. Let's work together so that we as local authorities, along with maybe the GLA and other bodies, it could be other developers as well, to sort of look, give us the ability to see with a much more ease of CPO powers so that we can unlock the development and building the homes, because homes is the foundation which we all build our lives from. And if that's not right, for whatever reason, it impacts our work, education, our children, all of it, our mental health. So it's the foundation, it's so key, and we've got to be working together, as has been mentioned by the panel earlier, because we cannot do it alone. But as local authorities, we have the experience, we have the expertise, we have that ability to bring in that to the table so that we can work together, so that not only our residents today have decent homes, but we're also building for the next generations to come. Thank you.
Thank you. And at this point, I would like to bring in Vince as obviously a council leader that doesn't have the same form of devolution. And I would like to ask him what form of devolution or further powers would be most beneficial to Medway, to you, so that you can also deliver the homes that you need in your area. And if you want to tell us a bit more about the blockages, the barriers, the infrastructure issues that you're facing. And then I'll finally bring in Sharma to sort of summarise before we open up into questions from the floor. So Vince, please do share your experience of Medway.
Thank you very much, Catherine. And my chair of over review and scrutiny is in the audience, David Field, so I need to be incredibly careful about everything I say. So as a local authority, a unitary local authority in the southeast of England, devolution is new gumming. And I think it should have wrote to all upper tier authorities very early on in this new government. And I think it's fair to say our position historically, from a Medway perspective, is there is no great appetite for a mayor of Kent and Medway, but there is an absolute desire for greater investment, greater powers, greater resources, greater collaboration with Kent and our districts and boroughs. So we're working through that, to use that phrase that we use too often when we don't really know what all the answers are. What would be helpful to us, I think, in Medway? So I think I agree, we're all pinning quite a lot of hopes on the MPPF. We're hopeful that's going to give some positives. One really specific issue, which is not unique to Kent, but is a real problem in Medway, is permitted development rights. So that we want the right homes, and we want them as soon as possible. What we don't want is conversions, as we've seen in Chatham, of a 15-storey tax office, not putting a single penny of Section 106 funding into our community. And then, moving on to a point that was made earlier on, the vast majority of that building being used by a London borough, not on this panel for the avoidance of doubt, to shift people down because of their real huge challenges. And I don't criticise individual councils because we've done it. You've got this bizarre situation, not unique to London and the South East, where we're both a receiving council of people from other parts of the country, particularly London, and then we're moving people to other parts of the country as well. For me, the housing crisis is complete. Residents are 50, 100, 150 miles away. Nobody got into politics to do that. So it is a problem, and I think it's one which has sadly probably amplified itself over the last few years. I'm in a crowd where this line will make sense because normally you don't want to get into the granular detail. Since 2010, there's been a 64% cut in planning departments. That is a real problem. So, we could get all the, MPPF comes, everybody goes, hallelujah, let's get on and build some stuff. The system will creak. It's creaking now. It will creak further at the edges. So, absolutely. I mean, as other local government colleagues have rightfully mentioned, we need resources, but not just for the sake of it. There are real practical issues in delivering those missions for the government, which, of course, we've got to play a key role in. And also, we need, the infrastructure. Time and again, actually, knocking on doors, not just in Medway, but across the region, actually, when this issue comes up on the doorstep, the most common response is not, I don't want new housing. The most common response is, I know we need new housing, but we need the infrastructure to go with it. And we've all got to play our part in that. Sometimes it's about, the messaging being clear. So when people are being shown great presentations from developers, at the moment, they forget to say, that new health provision is coming. The bit around after the 999th house is sold is a bit quieter. So that's where I think we need honesty from all sides to say, actually, this is a route map to this community. all looking fine. Been helping us since we took over up to and including July the 4th. And the conversation is already better in just the last few weeks than it was in that last year. Let me give you two examples quickly. Firstly, on day number one, so local government colleagues will know there's that bizarre bit between the election when you win and then when you take over the council. So the day one after we took over the council, the chief executive said to me, yeah, we need to have a small conversation. DCLG, not DCLG, whatever the acronym was, it's already gone from my mind like Michael Gove, has told us they're withdrawing our £170 million of housing infrastructure funding, which was of revolutionised and opened up so many doors to trying to get that much needed infrastructure in place. And then just roll on a few months later, last December, you've got the bizarre situation where Michael Gove's writing to us saying, your local plan's out of date, we knew that, we've been running the council at that point for less than 6 months, pretty much. And at the same point, one of the big drivers of why that delay is happening is because Highways England has got kind of a standing objection because their infrastructure is not suitable for use just on the borders of our community as well. So those two government bits need to talk to each other. And again, a joined up government approach, smashing down the silos of Whitehall, whilst at the same time devolution happening to all parts of England, is kind of the big ticket, which I think will help move us forward on this. We've got to make progress on this. There are too many people who are 35, 40, 45, living in their parents' homes, not because they choose to, because they've got no other option. And if this Labour government, and I hope it does this as soon as practically possible, succeeds, we'll see that going away over the years to come. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, my son is almost 19, and the prospect that he's not going to go anywhere until he's 45 fills me with dread. So if nothing else, I'm committed to the delivery of more new homes. Sharma, would you like to quickly summarise? And I know from your work in Brent and also the wider YIMBY movement, your insights and the reflections that you might have had from listening to the panel so far and what you'd like to add, and then we'll open it out to the floor.
Thank you. And it's great to have a panel discussion where there's some food available, because at conference, food is where you grab it where you can. I think some of my reflections in terms of my YIMBY hat, Labour YIMBY hat on, but also my hat on with the Regen lead in Brent. It's great to be at a Labour conference where housing is central to so many housing events, and how much it's central to almost every discussion going in terms of kind of what the Labour agenda is going to be in government. And it's really, you know, I think for most of us on this panel, well, most of us in this conference, housing is a social justice issue. It's a massive point of how people's life outcomes are going to be improved, like opportunities. And, you know, anecdotally, from when I was a teacher, before I came into politics, I knew that any child or any student of mine, part of the reason they will succeed at school is the ability of having secure housing, the space to study at home, the space to have, like, you know, feeling secure that they're not going to be moved on from one place to another. And so it's a real social justice issue and inequality issue for all of us here. So I think in terms of context of Brent, we are very prominent over the last decade. And I'm the longest serving region lead in London, I think, now. And we're very, very proud of the work that we've done in strategic relationships that we have with developers, with landowners, with residents and other public sector bodies. And part of the success of that is, you know, having Brent is very, very well connected. We have 23 tube and train stations in the borough. We're the second most connected borough in London after Westminster. So we have the opportunity to free up land. We actually are 455 homes being developed on our Wembley Park Station car park. You know, in Northwest London, that's really unusual considering how much noise there is around station car park development. But what we have put in place is policy frameworks within planning, within our region, within our borough plans to make sure that we're making sure that we're sending signals out to residents, but also to our backbenchers, to our communities, and to the market about what we expect in terms of red lines, in terms of affordability, in terms of quality of housing, because that's a real, real issue for us, and you get that across the sector. So I think, you know, we're very lucky, and I think what's great to see is the dial being moved in terms of being pragmatic approach to policy around housing, about there is a massive crisis, and I think there's work done by the Centre for Cities that if we'd been building at the same rate as our European partners, we would have had 4 million homes being built currently, 4 million more homes. And if you look at the numbers that were just quoted earlier, there'll be a very different thing. And since Liz Truss's budget, you know, the TA question, the temporary accommodation question in London has gone off. Considering London councils are spending £90 million a month on temporary accommodation, and considering the state that local government are in, that is not sustainable. It's not just the financial consequences, it's the social consequences. Schools are being closed because there aren't enough families living in parts of London anymore. And we can't have that for the fabric of our communities. So I think, but there's a lot of doom and gloom, but what's exciting for those of us who are in this policy leadership is actually the opportunities that what Labour are kind of talking about. So devolution is really exciting. Now, we've got it in London, and there's still tweaks to be had and what can be made better. But being mission-led, meaning that public sector bodies should be working together, and I think working in silos has been a big problem. It's taken me 6 years to get one medical centre approved and built by with the NHS for a scheme that we're doubling the density of housing. That should not be taking 6 years to get over the line. So there's a working, how we work with other public sector bodies. I think there's an element of opportunities around what growth looks like. And there was a really interesting discussion yesterday with Kim McGuinness, who's the mayor of Northern Northeast, and Liam Robinson, about what does inclusive growth look like. And it's about understanding your place and trusting local leaders to understand what their needs are for their communities and how you build on that. And I think, you know, trusting in kind of another key ask from as a local government leader is two things: how we incorporate the voice of those that don't have housing security. What can we change in the planning system to hear from those on the council housing waiting list? In Brent, we've got 30,000 homeless. It's real issues. How do we hear their voices at planning committee, not those voices that have housing security and they just don't want their view to be distracted? But secondly, how do we finance it? Ambitious councils like Brent will look at ways of funding social housing, but we need public borrowing to be cheaper. We want to kickstart the market again. We want to be building again. Public borrowing is expensive. HRE is at its maximum. We need to kind of levers to make public borrowing cheaper, and so we can get the returns that we need. We need affordable grants to be flexible. At the moment, it's one size fits all, and start dates are difficult. Viability is, if I'm being frank, screwing us all over. And land value capture is something we need to be looking at as well, about how we, and London disproportionately is affected by land value for the, an exacerbating inequality. So I think it's not all doom and gloom. And what I'm really excited about, and while the Tories are, pitching further and further to the right, Labour are actually looking at mission-led, sustainable, structural changes to the system that needs to happen about long-term. And I'm really proud and actually looking forward to working about a 10-year renewal and not just short-term fixes, because there are some systemic issues that need to be fixed and it will take longer than a one term. But I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
That was a great summation there, Sharma. Thank you so much, as always. We're now able to open it out to the floor to take questions. I've got colleagues with radio who's going to take one of the radio mics, and I will take you in groups of three. So I have the two gentlemen with the cap and the glasses, and the gentleman sat next to him, and then the gentleman on him, and the organisation or the CLP that you're representing.
My name's Ian McKenzie. I live in Lewisham. I work in Essex. Can I just say, before I ask my questions, it's about top down and bottom up. What a panel. You've got my mayor and friend. You've got one of my heroes. Anthony, I'm pretty sure I interviewed you as the external chair. I did, in 18, yeah. Sido, well done in Enfield North. Good lad. I don't know Councillor Maple, but I do know your chief whip. He says you're all right by me. And John Denham. John Denham stood for Parliament in 92 and he won it. I organised the hustings at the university down there. Strangely enough, the first question was about fox hunting. I don't know how that happened. But John moved the motion in 1975 that brought our party into sanity. Anyway, enough of that. So, top down, bottom up. Top down, devolution's great. Let's not argue about it. But my worry is that you put another third layer in where there are two-tier authorities, you've got a real problem. For me, it's like putting a plaster cast on a broken arm without setting the arm first. So my plea is that people in government think, and this is where I work in Basildon, by the way, People say the biggest achievement of the 1945 Labour government was creating the NHS. It wasn't, they're wrong. It was creating Basildon, right? You're supposed to laugh. So for two-tier, it's great. You can build houses, but you have to wait 2 or 3 years while the county authorises the road. Top slot. You can negotiate Section 106 with lots of developers, and then the county come and top slice millions off the top. So can we please have the two approaches taken together? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alex Toll. I'm the editor of Red Brick Blog with Labour Housing Group. And quickly, if you are a Labour member here and you like housing, please join LHG. We'd love to have you. So there's been a lot of chat since the election of kind of more regional spatial planning, particularly kind of extending that devolution framework out to the rest of England. Given we have lots of great London housing leaders here, what do you guys think we can have learned from the London plan that we can kind of expand forward in the devolution framework to other combined authorities as planning gets devolved to that level?
Thank you. Mike Leonard from Birmingham City University. That's a small town north of Watford Junction. So seems underrepresented at this conference. I might add that it's all about London. So there you go. Quick question, really. So Angela Rayner has just given a strong indication that the budget will include a big reference to social housing. Does the panel think it's a really good idea to get that social housing built using local materials produced in the UK and using local skilled labour to get full employment so that we actually get the growth opportunity rather than importing things from abroad and losing that opportunity to maximise on the multiplier?
Okay, thank you for that. And Vince, if you're in terms of the layers, and do you fear the third layer, as Ian phrases it, or do you feel if the devolution structure is right, that it will strip away the barriers fundamentally? And what's your perception of that? If you could come back on that one, and then we'll follow up on the Alex's question, and then Mike's quickly. So your response to Ian's question.
Thanks very much, Catherine. Thanks for the feedback, Ian. Always good to hear good things about our whip. And well done for being on the second best side of the Thames Estuary. Working there, obviously. So I think this is a real challenge. So I think, so Kent and Medway is a really good example of this. So we've got a county, a unitary, and districts and boroughs. And I think it's fair to say there is not... And some of this is not about what colour rosette people are wearing, interestingly. This is about where people are in the structures. Part of the reason I've never been a huge advocate for the mayoral model is I think it is complex. I think one of the things which has posed a new question, and I've said this elsewhere, and actually goes back to conversations John and I have had over the years around who speaks for England, the Council of Regions and Nations could be really important, but I'm not sure anybody quite knows yet. And I think, therefore, the question will be, how do we make sure that the 2 million people that live in the footprint of the County of Kent and the Unitary Authority of Medway, how do they have a voice at that table? I think there are other ways to get somebody to be that voice that isn't necessarily as indirectly elected mayor, and time will tell as to whether the others in that conversation has that view. I think there is a conversation. If you look at the map, it doesn't take a genius to see the bits of the country where devolution is not at the same place elsewhere. And I suspect colleagues from other local authorities that are mentioned on this panel will say even where there is a level of devolution, that devolution isn't finished yet either. They'll speak for themselves, I'm sure. So I think it is more complex. I've only ever represented a unitary authority. I've only been on Medway Council. I have never had to answer the question of, no, that's not me, that's the other councillor that represents this area. I get even that fundamental, it poses more questions when it comes to stuff like we're talking about today.
Thanks. John, did you want to add to that one or take up any of the...
Well, if I could pick up Ian's and Alex's points and put them together. Ian, good to see you. I'm going to disagree on government initiating getting rid of two-tier council areas, because I think in those areas nothing will happen at all for 5 years on any of the things we've been talking about here. So I live in Hampshire. Hampshire, you'd have to get rid of 13 district councils and you'd have a massive unitary that nobody would want. or you have to tear up the unitary councils and have a greater Southampton, a greater Portsmouth, and whatever. That's actually something I advocated during the local government review in the 1990s, but it didn't find favour, and I don't think it would now. So the difficulty is that whatever conception you could come up with, the political organisation popular response comes in. Too difficult. It's a long time ago, but between 1981 and 1984, I was on the South Hampshire Structure Plan, which was a county council legal statutory spatial planning of the sort that we don't have outside London at all now, even where the mayors theoretically have got those powers. I could drive you around South Hampshire tomorrow and point out more or less all the boundaries that we determined in 1984 about what would happen where. It's only really in the last 10 years that that plan has become out of date. If you have a proper strategic planning authority, the district councils work within that framework. And most of them, not all of them, but most of them would prefer to work within a locally generated spatial plan than what they work in at the moment, which is a computer-generated algorithm of housing numbers that come out from MHCLG by people who've never visited the place they've just announced the numbers for. So localize it in that way. I think that is the best way forward. And the reason I was saying earlier, just to reinforce it, get the spatial planning structures in now as its shadow bodies, legislate for them in the bill, do it for Kent and Medway, and then Kent and Medway can work out the rest of their relationship in the years ahead. But you'd then be able to get at least some of the housing development underway in a way that had been strategically but locally agreed.
Thank you. Kevin or Graham, anything to add on Alex's question around the regional spatial planning and what can be learnt from the London plan in that regard quickly? Or
yeah, I think the particular thing I would say from the London plan is ensure that it is spatial and strategic. The current London plan is 542 pages of policy, which laid on top of the UDPs or the local plans of local authorities that could be of similar size. The local authority planners are absolutely bogged down by a minefield of policies.
Thanks. And then moving on to Mike's question around ensuring that the growth in social housing is done and provided and delivered locally in terms of resourcing skills. And I think this speaks to Sharma's point. I was also at the inclusive growth event, and that's very much in line with what Kim and Liam were saying. I don't know if any of the council leaders wanted to sort of pick that up quickly as well. I would feel as though, Mike, you get a ringing endorsement for the sentiment behind that and allowing the local authorities to get on and do more of that. Anyone to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's an absolute key fundamental. If we're going to go around sustainable, inclusive growth, that actually the local circular economy needs to be involved in how they shape and plan and deliver outcomes for local communities. So I think part of the ask and Rachel's message seems to be around, it's not just investment and money that's needed, it's about reform. So in local government, sometimes procurement processes are really, really struggling and they're really, really difficult to kind of navigate. And it often leaves out SME builders or smaller contractors who actually could be supporting the local economy, but they don't have the bidding powers that the big guys have. And actually what we need to be able to do is have those powers and support and resourcing to make the procurement process better suited for local SMEs and to builders who want to include. There is local jobs, local builders and local things going on. So I do think there is a really strong argument that actually there's a lot of things that we can do, and reform doesn't take much to enable things to be unlocked. And part of that is procurement powers and tendering processes that local government are controlling over. And the other bit is about workforce strategy. So making sure that local government have the ability to have enough personnel to deliver the things that they need to deliver. So at the moment, the planning reforms say about 600 odd new planners. That's essentially one planner per authority. And when there's a shortage of building regs officers, can I make a point that the building regs needs to come back in-house, because at the moment the independent assessment system is not good. But you need to have a workforce strategy around growth. And if we can do that locally, and having local leaders understand and local communities understand what that looks like, is really powerful. So I think there's reform that can be done, but it doesn't need a huge amount of investment. It just needs some clarity thinking and working closely with local leaders.
Thank you. I'll take one more round of questions. Anything that's not been asked or isn't related to a question already answered would be really useful at this point. So I've got a hand there, and then gentleman there was first, and then the lady with the glasses. But then the thing to say is that the room is available for networking, so you're very happy to remain in the room after these set of questions and continue to sort of engage and talk about the issues for a little bit longer. So, gentleman with the glasses, thank you if you want to ask your question.
Hi, my name is Christian Meadows and I work for Riverside Housing, which is probably one of the biggest housing organisations, not always getting everything correct. But when I speak to customers a lot, this isn't things that a lot can our face about building on green spaces and things like that. I just wanted to know, basically, is there somewhere that I can either direct them to or that you guys know of where I can refute that we're just going to pave over countryside? Because we know that's not true, realistically, but it seems to be peddled constantly by this alarmist rhetoric. And I wanted to also know whether or not there's any plans to build on brownfield sites in particular, because there are a lot of those.
Cheers. My question is about, I'm Connell, by the way, from Trafford Council. Apologies about that. My question is about spatial frameworks. And in Greater Manchester, 10 local authorities make up the GMCA, and they all signed up for the Places for Everyone spatial framework. And then Stockport Council dropped out of that. I just wondered what it should be for those local authorities who do drop out. And then should they still get the benefits of being part of the command authority, but don't want to be putting in the hard effort of building houses from there? Like, what should happen for that? And yeah, that's just my question.
I think they're going to go on Angela's naughty step in the first instance, and then we'll see. And a question from the lady there.
Thank you. Mostly I'm asking a question because I thought a woman better ask a question from the floor. My name's Sarah Hayward. I used to be a leader of a local authority in London, and before that I worked for John in the last Labour government, so like Ian, I sort of know various members of the panels in various different ways. I'm currently chairing a housing organisation called The Key that's got pension fund finance from Phoenix, which is actually a really exciting new way to bring money in without using grants. But my question wasn't about that. It was actually going back to a point that John made in his opening comments and various other members of the panel touched on, and how we talk about housing as a labour movement in the first place and what we mean by affordability. And John obviously said he's old enough to remember, I think I paraphrased correctly or quote correctly, sorry John if I'm doing you a disservice there, but to remember when social housing was council housing. They're interchangeable. Back when I was a council leader, you'd say we've secured X amount of affordable housing on this site, and people would come back and go, affordable for who? What is it? The model that I'm working on at the moment is flexi rent, so it's a proportion of salary, not a proportion of the prevailing market rate, which makes it much more affordable for people. But affordable has just become this amorphous word that a lot of people seeking housing see as a SOP to cover up expensive homes that are a little bit cheaper than market. Again, sorry to the colleague from Birmingham, but particularly in London in the southeast where housing is so expensive. So do we need a rethink as a movement about how we talk about housing and who it's for and who it's affordable for? And if we do, have you got any suggestions as to what? And to be really clear, I ebb and flow in my view of that as to whether we should just try and reinforce the language we've got or whether we should try and develop new language.
Okay, thank you. So we'll take Christian's first question, which is around the narrative and explaining to local communities and addressing their fears and perceptions about that we're going to deliver all these homes on green spaces. I think the new legislation makes clear, certainly the conversation yesterday was around the grey belt definition. The hierarchy seems to be brownfield sites, the grey belt, and then strategic release of green belt that is not fulfilling its purpose, as Mikey heard from some of the messages yesterday. But I wonder if either Kevin again wants to come in on that, or one of the local authority leaders wants to talk about an example where they face that sort of narrative and how best that they've addressed it. So Kevin, do you want to start quickly on that, and then I'll bring in Anthony, if that's all right with you. Is that fine?
Yeah, I think Caroline, I think you've just summarised it absolutely perfectly. The priority is, from the government's rhetoric, to actually deliver on brownfield sites first. That's the priority. Densify as much as possible in line with what infrastructure is there available. And that's been the priority for decades. And it's been reinforced even further by the new MPPF. Then once you've gone beyond not being able to deliver your housing capacity in your region or your area on brownfield sites, then you start to explore the sites, and it's the lower quality greenfield sites or grey belt. I mean, we're getting into technical belts, but yeah, the grey belt it would be the next area to be released.
Right, so to the point on green spaces, I guess one thing to note, so in Greenwich we had a site called The Brooks, and it was building on existing brownfield land, lots of green spaces, people walk their dogs there. We're building about 80 homes there, right? Huge outcry from the community about, you know, what is this going to do to my house prices and all that kind of stuff. Now, I think people's attitudes to housing sometimes comes through in some of these kind of arguments, but I think sometimes we don't do quite well in celebrating successful development. You guys have been able to do really good in demonstrating what great successful development look in trying to restitch a community, trying to redevelop a community, you're trying to get new public realm. It's really given spaces for that to really exist, but also bringing those voices that are always going to object and those voices that might be helpful together, because what you will find is that they begin to counteract each other. So in our site on the Brooks, we brought the little nursery on, we brought community people on, we brought the objectors on. We said, look, we're going to build you a new playground. It's go away and design it. And, you know, that's really helped bring a community together. Now, that all said, it's been slowed down by modular, but it's happening, right? So I think there's real good examples on where, through engaging people and bringing voices together, I think you can overcome that easily and always set the right attitude for great housing. Because we don't celebrate great housing enough, right? We talk about what we need a lot, housing crisis, but actually there's some really great stuff that we're doing. To the point on price or language, I think it's one that we're always going to struggle with. I think there's always going to be a debate about affordable housing and all that kind of stuff. What I found really useful and successful is actually talking about price, and I think, you know, there's going to be sub-layers about language on what we do with affordable housing. You know, we have our house building company, which no longer a house building company, separate from the council, but we always try and talk about price and linking it to local incomes, because actually people see that as more affordable when you're thinking about it in the context of what you can afford. It makes it a lot easier. So that's kind of where I would go with that. I don't think we're ever going to get great language that, you know, makes people feel comfortable. Everyone's always going to have a problem at some point or something. And I say that because, and yeah, we all can disagree, but I say that because we do need to build on parts of the green belt. And actually, when we build on parts of the green belt, what we need to demonstrate is that we're creating successful communities that support public health, that tackle those things that we're going to be doing, that those challenges in the future, that isn't just about a community that's just got car driven, that encourages people walking, cycling, that thinks about a sustainable community. Greenbelt release is already happening across the country, it's been happening for years. What we need to focus on is getting it right.
Do you mind if I just quickly come in on a couple of the points, actually? I think particularly on the kind of issue around brownfield versus greenbelt, and if we talk about spatial planning, brownfield still is an important part of land use, that we still need land for industry and jobs and employment. So actually the role of spatial planning is massively important. So in my context in London, in West London, for example, we've been given targets by the mayor in the London plan about industrial land and capacity and intensifying industrial brownfield sites and not just releasing it all for housing. So spatial planning is massively important to understand land use, about where we need it for housing, for agriculture, for industry, for protected green space, for transport. So it's important that we make a distinction that it's brownfield, we're not going to build enough housing on brownfield land to meet the need. And I think that's important as well about when we talk about social housing. As much as I'd love to say all new housing should be social, if we address supply, affordability will not become the issue. The supply is the actual key driver here. So if we're building enough, pressures on council housing waiting lists will drop. But it's about the kind of that we have to build forward around and where we build. And so making sure that infrastructure matches. The fact that we've had the debacle around HS2, which could have built so much housing in key areas, and now that's gone to pot because of what the Tories have done, I think there's an element of actually we've got to be much more radical and the opportunity is there now to be radical around land use. And I think that's really important. We've turned the dial on what green belt is, what grey belt is, and how we have good green ecological land, but also land for industry, jobs, and housing, and agriculture, actually, as well.
Thank you.
I just have to come back, because I think that was such an excellent point well made, right? Is that at every point, we need to be assessing land use for its need. And I think that's the culture. It's not saying, oh no, we can't touch this, oh no, we can't do it. It's constantly reviewing, constantly assessing, constantly making the specifications and justifications of why that land use might need to remain or change. Sorry, Brenda.
Thank you. I just wanted to also add, and I think Anthony sort of mentioned it as well. So in Lewisham, we have a statement of community involvement, and that's where we're sort of challenging developers to get in early with that, getting the community and having those conversations, having those meetings, because hearing everybody's voice is important, and bringing people along, making sure they understand what is the benefit of whatever the development that's coming forward is. Also, locally, you've got, you know, what's metropolitan land, what's sink, and, you know, you can decide, you know, within your area where you want to protect and where you it's MOL. Should it be MOL? No. We should be sort of releasing that so that we can build on it. But there are other areas where we want to build or protect as like spaces that the community can have as a nature reserve, etc. But then you've got what I was talking about earlier about land banking in those areas too. So it's getting that balance right, which sort of touches on what Anthony's saying about that constant review and not being afraid to say, no, we really need to build here. And the other point I wanted to make was regarding affordability. Yes, that has been flip-flopping. Is it social? Is it council? Is it affordable? And do you count affordable umbrella? The realistic point is the fact that we need to make sure it is flexible. We are looking in Lewisham about having that kind of more flexible approach to rent in one of our developments. At the fortunately at the moment, it's not viable because of the interest rates, inflation, etc. But we will get there. But it's making sure that we have a broad tenure that we can meet all those different sort of rents and costs, so it can reach be fitting to everybody's pocket. So I just wanted to add those points.
Yes, it's a live debate, especially around student accommodation, where you're providing the right sort of housing at the right stage of life. And that's the broader point about having that mixed tenure and mixed form of housing, especially as you all get older and need more social care and to the point about housing for young families. So that generational provision of housing is important. John, did you want to comment at this point to add on any of those?
My view is you cannot sensibly have one member of a combined authority simply saying we're not going to play ball with spatial planning. So the question is, how do you resolve that question? And there are two models. One is effectively majority or qualified majority voting or something of that sort, and the other one is the mayor gets to decide. My strong preference is actually to leave it with the local authorities to resolve and come to the compromises. And the mayor may well have a really important role brokering agreement between the local authorities, but I don't think you can have a situation in the combined authorities where spatial planning effectively just gets booted upstairs to the mayor's office, because that will make the relationships with the local authorities much, much, much harder. But in truth, you cannot have what I've been advocating all afternoon and then say, but it's a voluntary process if you don't want to take part. It's a nonsense.
And so I'll hand that back to Sido, who's going to close the event. But as I say, we've got the room for slightly longer. I just want to thank you as chair for being such a great panel and also being such a kind and generous audience. And I hope you found that as informative and interesting as I did. My only other speaking engagement in public life is I'm a match day announcer for a non-league football team, the mighty Dulwich Hamlet. And I was so pleased when I didn't have to announce any substitutions to the squad today, and it wasn't cancelled due to poor weather. So thank you so much for attending, and I'm hand back to my colleague Sido to conclude.
And I'd like to thank you. What has been for me a really insightful panel, and I hope the audience would also agree. I mean, we've heard a number of quite fantastic contributions, I think, not least from Graham, who's talking about the revolution that Places for London and TfL are at least attempting by building the thousands of new homes across our car parks and across our quite well-connected transport network. Heard in TfL, and of course, whether it's the introduction of the Bakerloo line, or indeed the extension of it in places like Lewisham, we can really start to see the unlocking of new homes that we need in that part of South London. And of course, there's Sharma Tatla, who has shown us over the past 10 years exactly the kind of formula that's needed to unlock in new house building in her part of Brent. And of course, Anthony, whom in his only 2 years as leader and many more years to come, is showing the unlocking of new homes and the house building needed to jolt the housing solution in Greenwich, hopefully bringing a new cultural centre and attracting new people to his part of London. And of course, John Denham, who has given us his insights around not just spatial planning, but what's really needed to unlock the kind of house building that we do need to see in England. And of course, Kim Henson, whose expertise at Gerald Eve and indeed as a planner is showing us the kind of reforms that we need to see that causal link, decline of house prices and increase in affordability. And of course, we've got Councillor Vince Maple, who's shown that you can be a YIMBY even outside of London, and bringing forward the reforms that are needed in that national movement. We do have more sandwiches towards the end, back of the room. Please feel free to stick around. And I'd also like to thank Dan in our team and Jack, who have helped to facilitate a lovely event. So thank you all. Thank you for listening. And I hope you continue to listen to the Better Places podcast. I've been Sidhu Dwyer, and thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, that's it from us. Thank you for listening to our special live recording from Liverpool. You can listen to our back catalogue of podcasts at conciliocomms.com/podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you listen on.